Greetings, you diligent devotees of the bell. It's ding dong darkness time, and I'm your host, Allison Dixon, bringing you another small dose of the strange and unusual, also known as Ding Dong Ditch. This topic was suggested to me by a dear friend and listener, April, whom I have officially dubbed my Appalachian correspondent due to the fact she lives in West Virginia and has no shortage of say what now to dole out from her neck of the woods. Murders, missing people, cryptids, the whole shebang. There's darkness in them thar hills. This week, though, I'm heading back to 1945 to talk about the tragic and mysterious case of the Sodder family from the tiny town of Fayetteville and a house fire that claimed the lives of five of their children. Or did it claim their lives? This story is every bit as befuddling as it is tragic, with many people believing the case to be unsolved to this day. What do I think? After all, that's part of the reason you're tuning in, right? Well, buckle up, ding-dongs, because this country road is definitely not taking you home. Let's start with the brassiest of brass tacks. Who were the Sodders? George Sodder was born Giorgio Sodu in 1895, and he immigrated to the United States via Ellis Island from the Sardinia region of Italy when he was just 13 years old. He eventually found work as a trucker in Pennsylvania, hauling supplies for construction sites and later moving coal for the mining industry in West Virginia. He met Jenny, a shopkeeper's daughter, who had also immigrated from Italy as a child, and the two married and settled down just outside Fayetteville, which served as a home to a lot of Italian immigrant families at the time. The first of their 10 children was born in 1923, and they would continue to add to their family and prosper with their business to the point where they became very respected members of their small community. It was the night before Christmas, and George and Jenny Sodder were settling in for the night along with 9 of their 10 children. The 10th was away serving in the army at the time of this incident. George and the two eldest sons had already turned in for the night around 10 p.m. Jenny and several of the youngest kids were still finishing up chores. Afterwards, the kids got permission to stay up and play with a couple of the new toys they'd received as gifts from their older sister, Marion, who worked at a dime store in town. Around 12:30 a.m., the phone rang, and Jenny awoke to answer it. She heard the sounds of a party, clinking glasses and laughter, and the voice of a woman asking for an unfamiliar name. But it sounded like a classic wrong number type scenario. She hung up and began to head back upstairs to bed, but she noticed all the lights downstairs were still on and the curtains were not yet drawn. Marion was asleep on the couch, so Jenny just assumed that Marion simply forgot to take care of those things after sending the littles up to the attic where their rooms were. Jenny joined George back in bed. A half hour later, around 1 a.m., Jenny was awakened again by the sound of an object hitting the roof of their house and then rolling down. After sitting up a few minutes longer to make sure there wasn't something else going on, she laid back down, only to be awakened once again around 1:30 by the smell of smoke. She raced toward the source of the smell to find George's office space on fire. She awakened George and they began herding their two eldest sons, John and George Jr., their toddler Sylvia, and Marion out of the house, all while screaming to alert the rest of the children in the hopes they too would awaken and come downstairs. But there was no answer from the children sleeping in the attic, and all attempts to go up to make a rescue were futile, as the stairway itself was engulfed in flames. And here's where things get extremely gut-wrenching. Imagine standing outside in the freezing cold in the wee hours of Christmas morning, your house on fire, being unable to account for 5 of your 9 children. Horrific enough, but then you try to call the fire department, only to find your phone, which had been perfectly fine only 30 minutes ago, is now not working. Then you go to use the ladder that's usually resting against the side of your house to climb up and get to the attic that way, only to find it's now missing. Then you think to yourself, hey, I can back one of my two work trucks up to the house and use that to boost myself up. Only then you find neither of those trucks, which were perfectly operational the previous day, will now not start. And then there were the further attempts to call the fire department to the house, which were hugely unsuccessful. Marion, the eldest daughter, ran to a neighbor's house, but they were unable to summon an operator. As a quick aside to those who are under the age of 35 or so and listening to this, back in those days, phone calls didn't just happen. You needed an actual human operator to connect the two parties, and this was especially true in more rural areas for a large part of the 20th century. And the fire department couldn't be roused at once, like you might expect if you call for fire assistance these days. The town relied on sort of a phone tree type system. You get hold of one guy, and that guy calls another guy, and so on and so forth, and that's how you get a fire brigade to your burning home. But keep in mind, it was also in the middle of the night on Christmas, and that also explains in large part why the all-volunteer firefighters, who might have been drinking and celebrating throughout that whole evening, were largely unreachable. The lack of resources in a very rural part of the country, especially on the heels of a big war and the Great Depression, also likely played a role in this. But someone who spied the flames from the road did manage to make it into town and rouse the fire chief, F.J. Morris. But there was just one problem. He apparently didn't know how to drive the fire truck. I'll probably circle back to that point when I'm going over the various theories, but for now, just know that every attempt to get the fire department out to the solder place failed abysmally, such that no one actually rolled up on the place until around 8 a.m. that morning, some 7 hours after the fire started. And that timber frame home had collapsed into the basement and burned to a pile of ashes, all while the Sodders had no choice but to look on in tortured agony. Later that morning, after a cursory inspection of the site, there were apparently no remains of the children recovered from the still smoldering debris. I say apparently because, according to Stacey Horn of NPR, whose work on this case has been more exhaustive than most, I'm linking her stuff along with a lot of other info on this case in the show notes, by the way, some firefighters later did claim to find some bone fragments and pieces of internal organs, but they did not inform the family of this. Instead, the chief told them it was likely the fire had incinerated the five children completely and that a more detailed search would be conducted when they could get more people to help, both after the holiday and after things cooled down. However, an understandably grief-stricken George and Jenny couldn't bear staring at the site any longer. Only a few days after the fire, George bulldozed 5 feet of dirt into the hole with the intention of memorializing what he believed to be his five deceased children. Immediately following the fire, an inquest as to the cause of the blaze was held, with the final verdict being that it was the result of faulty wiring. The children were issued death certificates, funerals were held. However, as time progressed, George and Jenny Sodder started thinking of all the things leading up to the event that didn't quite add up. I'm going to just go ahead and list those things right now, but in order to keep this thing from growing faster than an over-yeasted bread dough left in a sauna, I'm only going to stick with the things that seem most relevant to the case at hand. In the weeks before the fire, the Sodder house had a few different visitors. The first was a local life insurance salesman who tried to offer up a policy and was rebuffed by George. The salesman apparently didn't take too kindly to this. He not only proclaimed the house would likely go up in flames, but that his children would disappear. And this was apparently due to the fact that George was none too shy about expressing his anti-Mussolini sentiments around town, and some of the citizens had hard feelings about that. Now, let me paint you a quick picture again of 1945. Throughout World War II, Italy, one of the Axis powers, was led by their dictator, the architect of fascism himself, Benito Mussolini. Well, Mussolini was eventually deposed, arrested, and in early 1945, hanged by his own people. At this point, it was fresh enough that some hides might have been a little ruffled by smack talk about the fallen dictator, and this is part of the general discussion of this case, that George ruffled feathers of those sympathetic to Mussolini. How do I feel about that personally? Well, it's hard to say. On the one hand, I think if you'd immigrated to America from Italy during the early 20th century, you might have been interested in escaping a fascist regime, and you might also be pretty happy about the final outcome, as George Sautter was. That said, if your identity and sense of pride are still tied more to the overall status of Italy as a world power, its defeat might make you feel a little sore. That's my general summation anyway, which is all to say, I can see how there might have been some division among Italian immigrants in the post-World War II era. But that wasn't the only visitor that set upon the Sautters in the pre-fire weeks. A stranger also happened on the property and mentioned to George how the double fuse boxes used to power the property might pose a fire hazard. George didn't think much of that, however, because he just installed an electric stove and had a local utility company deem the whole setup as safe. Additionally, some of the kids had noted a random car parked along the road, with people seeming to watch the house and the younger kids as they came home from school. So there were some interesting developments leading up to the fire. And how would you feel if I told you that one of the people on the inquest jury who declared the fire to be caused by faulty wiring was none other than the man who tried to sell George Sautter life insurance and made a strange threat about his house being set on fire? You'd think that more than a little crazy, no doubt, but it's completely true. Add in that during further inspection of the house, George found a sort of hard rubber object that resembled a common bomb used in warfare. Might have been some kind of artillery shell or grenade. The accounts here vary, but an object was apparently found, and some people did attribute it to some sort of incendiary or explosive device. And then the sightings of the children began once the case hit the media and people started thinking about what they did or didn't see around the time after the fire. One woman claimed that children who looked a lot like the Sautter kids were in a passing car during the time when the fire would have been in progress. That seems a little flimsy to me, but it's one of the listed eyewitness sightings. The morning after the fire, some 50 miles west of the house, another woman later claimed to have served a gaggle of Italian-looking kids at a diner and noted a Florida license plate on the car they all arrived in. Later in Charleston, West Virginia, a hotel worker claimed to notice a group of children being herded by a group of men speaking Italian who were being hostile to her attempts to speak to the kids. They checked out early the next morning. In 1947, George Sautter contacted the FBI and asked for assistance. J. Edgar Hoover himself said he might be inclined to investigate the matter, but it would be up to the local jurisdiction to invite them in. They never did. The sightings continued to pile up, though, and the Sautters hired a private investigator by the name of C.C. Tinsley. He was the one who revealed that the one man on the inquest jury who ruled the fire was a result of faulty wiring was the shady insurance salesman. Tinsley also revealed one of the oddest elements of this entire case. Apparently, he earned the confidence of a local reverend who told a story of the fire chief, the one who couldn't operate the fire truck, who'd apparently buried a box at the site of the fire containing a heart. The hope being that if anyone uncovered it, they might be comfortable with the discovery of some human remains. That bit of heart, by the way, well, some folks went and dug it up and took it to a funeral home, and they determined it to be a beef liver. Truly, this is just so bizarre, but in a weird way, I could see the chief's motivation. If you truly believe the family was struggling to accept that their kids had perished in this fire, you might be compelled to put something in that site in order to convince them that they no longer need to keep looking, right? But to put it in a box? Yeah, maybe not the best idea, my dude. If anything, it only contributed to the misinformation and skepticism that swirls around this case in the present day. George continued to have other sightings of his kids over the years. One in particular from New York compelled him to visit and determine if it was his daughter Betty. He apparently saw her in a newspaper article. But when he went to visit, the girl's parents wouldn't let him speak to the child. In 1949, a more thorough investigation of the fire site commenced. It turned up things like damaged coins, parts of a dictionary, and even a few pieces of vertebrae. Later investigations, however, revealed that while the bones appeared to belong to a singular person around the age of 14 or 15, which just so happened to be the age of the eldest of the missing Sauter kids, there was no evidence the bones had been exposed to fire. It was later surmised that the place where George had gathered the dirt to put over the burn site had come from an old cemetery where some old human remains might have been present. And by the way, that's another thing about old cemeteries. A lot of those bodies are no longer in their coffins, in their graves. They're all kind of like just spread around under the dirt. It's kind of a fascinating thing, and maybe I'll do that as a topic one day. Local governments were no longer interested in this case, and by this point, the Sauters were convinced their kids had been kidnapped, perhaps even sold, by the Sicilian Mafia, who were after all sympathetic to Mussolini and also had a hold of the coal hauling business at the time. So they had some reason to come after George, right? Well, that's kind of a weak one as well, because George immigrated over here when he was 13 years old, and there are no other previous ties that he had with the mafia at all. So it's really just, again, another one of those stretches that almost feels like, Italians, mafia, it's got to be a connection, right? Well, not necessarily. The family, convinced that bringing more media attention to this case could only help, erected a billboard with the pictures of the kids' faces on it in the hopes that someone, anyone, would be able to point them in the right direction. They even offered a $10,000 reward for any tips, and boy, did that make the leads start pouring in. George would travel out to investigate each one. A young woman in a St. Louis convent, a Texas bar where someone talked about an infamous West Virginia fire, but nothing ever came from any of these leads. Then the picture arrived. In 1968, some 23 years after the fire, Jenny checked the mail and found an envelope addressed to her. Inside that envelope was a photograph of a man in his mid-20s, and there was a note written on the other side of it that was a little weird. It said, "Lewis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, lil boys, A 90132 or 35. That's just a code of some kind. And this Lewis person in the photo apparently looked a lot like their son, who had been 9 at the time of the fire. And he had the dark curly hair, dark brown eyes. He had the same shape of nose, the same shape of eyebrow. And once again, they hired a private detective to go to Kentucky to look into this, but they never heard from that guy again, which is weird. Like a PI just kind of goes missing as well. And no one seemed to follow that particular trail to see what happened there. But I thought that kind of interesting. The Sauters updated their billboard with the new picture and hoped that that would bring some new leads, but none ever came. Sadly, George died a year later in 1968, and Jenny closed herself away from the world. Apparently, she never stopped wearing black out of mourning for her lost children. Eventually, the billboard did come down, but the rumors never stopped. The kids were kidnapped by a mafia who had it out for George, sold off, possibly even murdered and buried somewhere. Some even surmised the kids grew to old age, but never reached out to their family out of fear it would cause either of them harm. But never again were the 5 unaccounted for Sauter children ever heard from. The siblings and grandkids also kept up the search and investigation over the decades to no avail. Online sleuths had a field day with this one, and still are, offering up all sorts of theories as to what became of those 5 kids and how they somehow managed to be secreted away in the night and never heard from. But what do I think actually happened here? I mean, after all, given all the elements from before, during, and after the fire, it really does seem like something shady went down. The response to the fire was beyond abysmal. Then the half-assed investigation, complete with a genuine conflict of interest. Add in the sightings and that picture, The mystery is irresistible to anyone who's even a little into true crime. Various podcasts and other media outlets have covered this case. There was even something just released on Investigation Discovery earlier this year. However, I'm about 99% certain those poor kids died in the fire. And you'll ask me how I think that's even possible, given that no remains were found. You might even scour through all the articles and Reddit posts that I did and ask what I think about the fact that no remains were recovered. The appliances were still intact, Allison, you might say. You might even refer to the fact that for a successful human cremation to take place, a body will have to burn at around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours. And even then, bone still remains bone. Bone that has to be put through a machine called a cremulator, I'll have you know, because surprise, surprise, I already know all about this process. What kind of dark goddess do you take me for? And also you will tell me, but Jenny did her own experiments and burned animal carcasses on a fire just to see if the fire would take them down. And there was always still bone left over. Allison, what do you make of that? Well, nearly all of these theories are based off the integrity of one detail, that a thorough search actually took place. And I hate to break it to you true believers out there, but it didn't. A couple of tired, put-out volunteer firefighters kicking around some cinders early Christmas morning in 1945 does not equal an exhaustive and thorough examination of a fire site for human remains in a fire that burned for 8 hours. Something even modern fire examiners have said does not hold up to the modern standards of an actual search. Yes, a human being might need to be burned at a couple thousand degrees for a couple hours to be fully broken down into little more than bone fragments, but what happens at many hundreds of degrees for 8 hours? There was coal in the basement as well, mind you. That only added to the equation. And then add in the fact that George dragged in a cubic meter or more of soil and dropped it over the site. Do you want to know the best way to break down a corpse to nearly nothing? Bury it in soil. Soil teeming with microbes that eat dead things. Soil that, hey, might have been dredged up in part from an old cemetery. Over a few years, those microbes will eat nearly everything down to nothing, especially if fire has already given it a head start. So that when an excavation crew comes along 4 years later, as what happened in this case, they may find nothing. Furthermore, let's just talk about how hard and nonsensical it would be to kidnap 5 children between the ages of 6 and 14. Tell me how you pull that off without alerting anyone else in the house, especially the 19-year-old sibling sleeping on the couch. Tell me how you do that successfully and then do what with them exactly? Sell them off? One or two of the youngest kids, maybe, I might be able to grant that. But all 5 of them? Not one of them daring to reach or speak out after so many years? The mechanics and motivation, even if you factor in a very questionable theory involving the Italian mafia, are just not there for me. Especially when you consider the kids were very likely in the attic, not far from where the fire seems to have actually started. Now, let's talk about that fire. How did it start, really? Over the years, the Sodders called into question the faulty wiring theory. After all, they'd had the wiring inspected not all that long ago after installing that electric stove. The utility deemed it safe, great, but we're still talking about a system driven by fuse boxes, which can be notoriously problematic and why you don't really see them in houses at all anymore. The Sodders claimed the lights were still on in the house during the early stages of the fire. Therefore, faulty wiring seemed unlikely to them. However, I did some research of my own on this, which included having a conversation with my very electrically inclined husband, and though this is far from scientific, we agreed that a problem with one fuse box does not preclude power being delivered to some areas of the home, even as a fire begins. Furthermore, if for some reason, say at Christmas time when extra lights are plugged in, this could overwhelm a fuse. And if someone who was familiar with the fuse boxes did a short hack to work around an overloaded fuse, it can be done with something as simplistic as a coin, by the way, to keep the power flowing, it's possible a fire could have spawned from that. Am I saying that George Sautter might have unwittingly created a condition in which his home caught on fire and the appeals to the media that came directly after was the result of a father's unimaginable grief and guilt, an inability to accept that five of his children perished in a fire he might have created simply by his wish to give his family a festive Christmas? I might be saying that. However, that's not the only possibility here. After all, Jenny reported hearing something hitting the roof of her home and rolling down, and I believe I already mentioned the strange pineapple-shaped rubber device found on the property. It could be completely unrelated, but let's just say there was an arson incident on the property. And let's say it was led by that very testy life insurance salesman who had every incentive to rule this fire the result of bad wiring. Perhaps he was wanting to teach that snobby know-it-all George Sautter a lesson about not buying life insurance to protect his home and family. He sets fire to the home. Maybe he didn't intend for five children to perish in that fire, but perish they did. Commence every form of ass covering imaginable in order to avoid accountability, and from there, the doubts and suspicions about the actual story about the Sautter children takes root. This is entirely plausible, especially when coupled with the trucks that didn't start, the lackadaisical response of the fire department, even by the standards of that day, and the obstacles of the holiday, which I already mentioned, and the fact that a phone technician who visited the site claimed that it appeared the phone lines to the home might have been cut. Someone very possibly had it in for the Sautters. Whether it was his politics or his unwillingness to play by the mafia's game, who can say? Either way, the mystery surrounding this family is all about what happened to their five children. And I can say with a confidence about as high as I can muster that those precious babies never made it out of the house that night. And everything that happened since was the result of a grief-stricken father and mother's inability to accept that horrific truth. And it's more likely that guilt from being unable to save them that night factored very much into that thought process. People will jump through the most unimaginable mental hoops to avoid facing consequential loss, especially if it involves children they loved and valued very much. It breaks my heart that so many people in the Sautter family lived out their whole lives following a trail of breadcrumbs that didn't really exist. As for the pictures and sightings I mentioned before, publicity and the promise of a reward have a lot to do with that, I think. Speak to any cop working a case where tips from the public are encouraged, and they'll tell you there's no shortage of people either trying to be helpful and failing, or those who are looking for a little attention or reward money. The person who sent the photo of that young man to Jenny might have had in them the same drive as the fire chief who buried that piece of beef liver at the site of the fire. To bring some strange measure of comfort, to quiet the worst of the voices, even if all they ever managed to do is elevate the chorus of doubt that has plagued this case for over six decades. The original Sautter home is no longer at all visible or otherwise apparent at the original site. Another house stands in its place, the memories of what happened there on Christmas Eve of 1945 relegated to the ghost bin. Discussions, many of them passionate, carry on in the realms of blogs, documentaries, and Reddit, but ultimately I feel they're chasing red herrings, still unable to make the same admission George and Jenny couldn't. That the lives of five young people were cut brutally short that night, and that an ash-filled basement became their grave. Whether by malice or accident is anyone's guess at this point, but given the strange circumstances surrounding the fire, let's just say I wouldn't be surprised if it was ever ruled an arson. I'm very interested to hear what you think about this case. There's a lot of information, and it's one hell of a series of rabbit holes to venture down, many of which I didn't bother mentioning here as I don't believe they were valuable to constructing a concrete theory as to what happened. If you've studied this case at all, you might have come to a very different conclusion. Feel free to reach out and let me know at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or over on Twitter at ddarknesstime. Better yet, drop on over to iTunes and leave me a review. It warms my cold, dead heart better than a lizard's heat lamp, I can promise you that. We're slowly approaching the season 3 premiere of Class of Cults, and October itself has extra spook in store. Fully expect me to bring some ditch episodes that have the creepy factor even more dialed up than usual, because that's how I roll around here. I'll be back next week with another one. In the meantime, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.